today on the Bird Gang Powerlifting Podcast.
Do you have an athlete or do you have a client?
Dominic Bazabas.
What got Carlina's deadlift from where it was to where it is now was kind of that West Side approach.
The Elite is our English series where we interview world-level coaches and lifters.
She was out-squatted, out-benched, out-deadlifted, out-coached by a lot. You tell me, where's the clothes?
Everyone, welcome on another episode of the Bird Gang Powerlifting Podcast. My name is Falk. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Mr. Maximilian Rabe from Berlin. And today we have another episode of The Elite with the one and only Dominic. He's the coach of the 76 world champ, Carlina Tongatea. How are you doing, big man?
Hello, sir. I'm good. Thanks, team. I just came back from Germany, obviously. And we were just talking about basically potentially running into each other, but not running into each other at Worlds. So, good to hear from you guys. And thanks for reaching out.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to be on the show. Obviously, you as the coach of one of the best lifters in the world, we also need to talk about her. And we had her on the radar, especially for not only her squat and her bench, which is like tremendous, but also her monster deadlift, like being pretty evened out in her performances in the lifts overall. Her deadlift could hang in the past and now can hang with the best in the world, also winning gold at Worlds for deadlifts. How do you structure her training for the deadlift? We noticed that there are quite a few variations you seem to program, but we didn't dive too deep into it. So please give us a little insight on it.
Oh, okay. If we want to start with the deadlift, let's start with the deadlift. So basically, I've been coaching powerlifting since like around about 2009, 2012. 2012 is when I started coaching strength sports competitively. And around about that time, what you'll notice, and like if you've been around for as long as I have, is there's ebbs and flows of trends, and the kind of the gurus of that time, and there's gurus this time, and so on and so forth. The gurus of that time was the West Side kind of method. And that's kind of how I was introduced to the game, so to speak. Obviously, as you learn through the game, you understand the differences between multiply and single ply and untested and all that kind of stuff. But initially, when it comes to strength training, I understood the value of variations, I understood the value of like what they were trying to do. So when it comes to her deadlift specifically, one of the philosophical thing that I do when I attack the deadlift specifically is it's probably that I see the conventional deadlift as the least technical of all the lifts. Most coaches will probably agree. And because it's the least technical of all the lifts, in my opinion, it's the purest expression of the physical components or the addition of all the physical components put together. So in terms of prioritizing what I want to prioritize for the deadlifts, I'm looking at probably midline rigidity. So her core rigidity through the back, so you can transfer force through the legs, and explosiveness, speed production. Because of that, and again, just marrying that with how I was schooled in the game, a lot of kind of what got Carlina's deadlift from where it was to where it is now was kind of that West Side approach where you have a day where you have the absolute strength stimulus that you're after for that training. And then you'll have the explosive strength stimulus. And that's kind of how I've approached it. And there's been changes throughout the years, but for the most part, that's how I approached it for her deadlift specifically from the beginning. She lines up pretty well, like from initial position standpoint. Also, I don't know if you ever, I know a lot of the times also in the community, you know, a lot of the coaches would say, you know, specificity, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. You got to practice the skill, the movement, all that kind of stuff. but I'm also, I coach a lot of people on site. So I've seen a lot of people walk to the gym, never done a deadlift before, deadlift 180 the first time. Okay, so then when I see that, I'm like, okay, well, you've never practiced this skill before, and I just teach you some positioning. What got you from zero to 180, right? So obviously, it's like the physical component. So breaking all of that experience down, breaking down like kind of how I get schooled in the game, breaking down how philosophically I would attack the deadlift, the programming ended up a lot more west side, so to speak. And that means bands. In the past, we used a lot of chains. Difference between being the bands, I'll attack it with more kind of acceleratory kind of approach. Change this more like if your strength curve is biased towards, I want to say, hold on. Yeah, it's stout towards the beginning of the lift, which is why it helps quite a lot for conventional deadlifts, right? And then at the top of the lift, they kind of have to grind it out. So if you're more worried about the strength curve being biased towards the beginning of the lift, I'd probably use the chains and then bands. And then there's also blocks and deficits and yada, yada, yada. And then understanding all those tools. And I've just really just worked each individual kinetic chain and then just kind of looked to add it up at the end and then create the deadlift as it is. From a skill standpoint, you can see her deadlift. She's pretty sharp with the skill. A top-down brace approach. So if we're looking at that too, you know, how much practice and specific practice with a deadlift would we actually need? Not that much. So then we'll break it down on through the physical components and try to develop it that way. And then again, with my experience, having sifted through all the gurus throughout the year, honestly, man, but Westside got a lot of crap, but like, it's not that different from when Mike T became the guru of the space. And then you hit a top single, which is your max effort day. And then you hit a bunch of volume days. So instead of like a speed day, you'll just do volume, you know? And then now you have the daily undulating situation and the concept of polarization. I think Powell was like big on that in terms of like each individual lifts or each individual stimulus for each individual day, really, really varying from each other. So yeah, like if you've been around the game for long enough, you'll sift through the gurus and they all pretty much say the same thing. They just try to achieve it in many different ways that accommodate for the individual lifter. So how I broke it down for many, many years, I actually program her a fortnightly program. So not a weekly,
what?
A fortnightly program. So not a weekly split.
So 2 weeks.
We'll go on odd week. Yeah. Odd week, even week.
Okay.
So 1 week we'll squat heavy. 1 week we'll deadlift heavy. So I'll try to separate that. So the heavy stimulus don't carry over on top of each other on the same week. So I'll have a heavy deadlift stimulus, I'll have a speed deadlift stimulus, and I'll have a skill deadlift stimulus, and then I'll have a volume deadlift stimulus. But so that's four stimulus instead of like what people do nowadays, fitting it all in 1 week. I'll spread it out throughout the fortnight, if that makes sense. Sorry, it's like a long roundabout way of kind of answering your question. But
no, but you are ticking many boxes and many more questions we had. So
yeah, that's kind of philosophically. I just wanted to explain kind of like how that came about. That got her from, I think, when she first started with me. And again, like another one of those people that goes into the gym. First time she deadlifted was 160 for our testing. So it got her from that to 255. And running primarily west side.
Massive, yeah.
So
I think it's also a modified west side, isn't it? And I also get the feeling that every polarized approach is meeting more and more in the middle, and everybody learns from everybody else.
Yeah, no. So it's always going to have to be modified for the individual, right? Understanding that there is value in a speed day, because I remember when Juggernaut was the guru at the time, they didn't value speed at all, it seemed like. Okay. in terms of a speed workout as it is. They just thought it was probably like too light for the raw lifter, right? But, you know, obviously you just alter the loads a little bit. And then Mike T had an answer for that because you just changed it to RPEs, right? So on and so forth. So you just sift through all these gurus, and now you have gurus nowadays, you know, the Powerlifting Now guys, and then Powell's obviously like popularized the six SBDs or whatever it may be.
Eight by now.
So I'm just going to wait and sit and then just learn from all the gurus and that want to tell us how they do shit. And I'm more than happy to learn. and yeah, add up all the accumulated wisdom and knowledge throughout the years. Yeah, that makes sense at all.
Yeah. Do you use the Speed Day for its original purpose to develop more speed and I guess, attack from the bottom? Or, what kind of weight ranges, percent ranges are we talking about there?
So to answer the first part of the question is yes. The purest form of conventional deadlift, if your skill is intact, right? For me, it depends on two things really. Again, like in the beginning, midline rigidity, okay, and explosiveness or bar speed. If you have both, you're good. And bar speed, a lot of the times, is intent. So I use the speed day to generate intent. So that's why a lot of the band deadlifts come through quite a lot, no more than 3 reps. This isn't entirely unusual for athletics as well. Like, so if you're if you come from an actual strength conditioning background, you know, athletics do this all the time. Like really, really powerful movements, right? But for me, it's a lot to do with intent, especially in the conventional deadlift. Chuck the bands on. Have you guys done band work for conventional deadlift?
I did. Back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day.
yeah. So I wouldn't use so much bands. So I think the smallest band, most bands are pretty standard, right? Smallest bands probably used for someone that deadlifts under 200. The second one up would be probably up to 220, 250. And then the next one up would be up to a 300 deadlifter. And I wouldn't use more bands than that. And it's just like one choke. And it's just like the bands will catch. And then you realize, ah, shit, I got to fucking accelerate the lockout, so to speak, right? I got to drive through the lockout. So yes, I would use that for, not from the beginning, not from the start of the lift. It's through the lockout. Most of the time, if someone's slow off the start of the lift, it's not actually speed, it's the midline rigidity that's the problem. Because they can't generate the force from their legs or the quads to break the floor because they feel like their midline's gonna break, if that makes sense. Not break literally, but like it's gonna soften out. That's why a part of what people do, conventional deadlifts, is they'll round immediately. And they're okay with rounding to break the floor, if that makes sense, right? But people that instinctively doesn't have that lunatic mindset, they'll just like kind of keep their back or like kind of have more priority over their back health kind of situation, and they just won't break the floor as fast. So if you're a conventional deadlifter, you're stuck off the ground, you're probably not subconsciously as confident with your lower back as you should be to really transfer the force from your legs. But yeah, that's how I would use it, not how Westside used to preach it, which is the bands will break off the floor fast. I would think of the bands as something to intent to speed through the top more so than anything.
So you wouldn't intend to make it super hard with a band? I think that's what we are knowing how to use bands. It's more like to force the lifter to give really much intent, but still keep it light.
For the most of the time I use it. So for Carlina specifically, what I've found over the years of working with her, and this is the actual breakdown of her training blocks, again, that worked from probably around about 200 to 255, is I want to say 2 weeks out, really heavy, double, something between a first attempt and a second attempt. Okay. Mm-hmm. 4 weeks out would be a reverse band deadlift. Okay. That's another another thing. 6 weeks out would be a band deadlift, so choking downwards. So that's a overload, and then an underload, choking downwards. And then 8 weeks out would be a block deadlift. High block deadlift. So really, really high. So the bar starts at the knee. So again, overload, and then I'll go underload for 10 weeks out. We'll go deficit or a block deadlift, not a high block deadlift. So it sounds funny because a block deadlift, you'd assume that you would get more weight off the ground. But if you're actually a good conventional deadlifter, a block deadlift would kill the legs at the beginning. So it would kill to initiate the lift. And it's all lower back, all glutes. So if you're actually a true good conventional deadlift, like a 20 kilo plate, like a 20 kilo bumper plate or something along that lines, if you do a block deadlift of that, it should be a little bit less than your actual deadlift because it's all back, all glutes, no quads, kind of to sort of speak. So again, breaking it down in components of the lift.
And do you try to find a pattern that works and repeat it? Or are you more about, let's challenge the lift from different angles and keep the variations changing over time?
You're kind of right for both. So challenge the lift at different angles. But it didn't take that long for me to find the pattern for her. So again, like underload, overload, double, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that's the pattern that worked. But the underload overload isn't weekly, it's fortnightly. So the stimulus, because like how Westside used to run it is they used to max effort every week, right? I wouldn't do that, especially for the natural lifter. You just get absolutely fried. But it is a true max effort. It's not like a top single at 8 or whatever. Again, similar method, just repackaged. It's pretty much the same. You know what I mean? But anyways... For the tested lifters, I'll run it once a fortnight instead of once a week, and run it separately with something that has overlap, which is the squat. And then, yeah.
Before we get to midline rigidity,
because this is just deadlift, by the way.
That's just deadlift. But we love to get in detail about it. You just said that when it comes to tested lifters, you do it fortnightly. Sounds sophisticated for everyone who doesn't know Fortnite besides the game, the Battle Royale game. It's that's a 2 week period of time. So with untested lifters, then you obviously...
I don't coach untested lifters.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I just immediately assumed when it was untested, I immediately assumed like, oh, let's be a little bit more conservative with recoverability. That's why I mentioned it that way.
All right. Okay.
Whatever they paint, instead of just saying like, oh, all that's bullshit, it's multi-fly untested, whatever. They squat high and all that kind of stuff. Like instead of thinking that way, I'm thinking, it's like, okay, what applies? What doesn't apply?
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. I was implicitly thinking that you maybe coach untested, right? Lifters too, and wanted to get into that maybe as well. But we put that aside.
I wouldn't know where to start.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because I don't train any untested lifters either, and that would be pretty interesting to talk about. But maybe we can get Tom Zero on the show one day and talk to him. He can give us a little insight.
I try not to pay attention, man. There's too much shit going on. Like you actually have to learn to focus. Like right now I don't have, I had actually one gentleman that performed in the A group, at Worlds. Yeah. But apart from that one weight class, I really try and, it's not that I don't give a flying fuck. It's just like I have to try to not pay attention to the other weight class because there's just so much shit. Like you actually have to focus. But the information that's relevant to you, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But then we can go over to midline rigidity and bracing maybe. So what's the, what are the methods to gain more midline rigidity? How do you teach bracing maybe? So what's your plan on going?
It's not a hot take, I don't think, because you you got to be really, really, really into powerlifting to think bracing is that important, but it's not fucking that important. it's not like you're going to use it on top of whatever you do, but like, you can't. So let me rephrase. So basically, so a lot of my lifters, I don't teach bracing until a lot later in their career. The mechanics of it, I understand how it's important, but it's not the end all be all. Like, so if you don't have, for example, so it's a bracing, the concept of bracing is software. So I break it down to software, hardware. The hardware is the actual, like, the way I break it down is the musculature that or the tissue that has to perform it, right? If the person that you have is the typical under-muscled, over-fat kind of novice, and they don't have the hardware to execute your software, right? Like teaching the bracing is redundant, right? Like you're trying to run like a good software, you know, on like a shitty laptop, so to speak. The way I break it down first is I actually have to build the hardware. So really, really do a lot of core work first, not only to have the musculature to support bracing as a concept, but also to build the proprioception necessary, right? When you do your core work, you know where your obliques are, you know where your abs are, you know where your erectors are, you know what I mean? So when you brace, it's a lot more effective, you know, because you have the good hardware to brace. So again, believe another guru wasn't big on bracing at one on core work at the time, but all they did was just brace, whatever, you know, they just squat. That's how they work their core, whatever. That's fine. They can believe that. But like, if you just think like, you know, as a person that doesn't have muscle through the midsection or enough muscle to support like proper bracing, then it kind of doesn't work as well. So my first priority, to go back to your question, when creating midline rigidity, is to work the muscle around and to actually build a core work around. And because the core muscles are quite proximal to your body, it gets a lot of blood flow. One of the things that we do, and I always preach, it's not even a fucking secret. It's we do two core works per workout at the end, 3 to 4 sets. And a lot of it's either isometric or just if they lack muscle itself, then it'll be more movement kind of based core work. But we do at least 2 per workout, you know, sometimes 1 at the beginning of the workout.
Every workout.
So you'll recover. It's proximal. Like you got blood flow all over here. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so comes to maximum recoverable volume. That's very high for your core. And you're not going to go heavy because at the end of your workout, natural fatigue of the workout will kind of make you kind of pull the loads down on that if you're loading it. So yeah, we do a shit ton of core work. And then I just teach basic bracing. you know, like you don't have to overcomplicate your cues, your instruction, blah, 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 blah. You know, because like, again, the more complex the software is, and if you have shit hardware, it's just going to crash the hardware no matter what, like, you know. So the priority for us is hardware through the core. I'm talking erectors and obliques. Those two are probably your priority. The abs, if you have someone that struggle with hyperextension on the or trusting their ab stack on the squat, then you could kind of work through the abs a little bit more. But yeah,
I think when we talk about bracing, it's a lot more about staying neutral and breathing in the right parts, because I think a lot of beginners just crunch down. So I really like that you pronounce the obliques more and not just like cramp and crunch down. But yeah, it's interesting that you do a lot of core training to enforce the midline rigidity.
Yeah, the brace and stay neutral and all that kind of stuff. Look, like, there's, if you've been in the game long enough, again, and also around the game, not just powerlifting, many people can keep their midline neutral without even knowing the concept of bracing, right? without even knowing the concept direction of intra-abdominal pressure, which again suggests that there's more to just the direction of the air, if that makes sense, or whatever it may be, to create midline rigidity. But yeah, so another good example is Joy Namani. So I coach Joy Namani as well. Doesn't use a belt. So obviously the bracing concept for her is completely different. She came to me after having won 2 world championships already. And then when we spoke about like some of her technique stuff, as I'm kind of getting to know her, it's not that she didn't brace. It's just that because without a belt, you know, lifting without a belt for so long, it's just the mechanics is so different for her, and kind of how we have to work the abs for her is so different, that again, it's more like, okay, like how important is this concept, you know, for midline rigidity? Mm. So like, or how important, how much more important is, like the hardware itself, and then kind of, yeah, hopefully that makes sense. So again, like, it's about experience for me. Like I'm seeing all these evidence like across the board, you know, that suggests that certain things aren't as important as people paint it out to be, you know? And it's about knowing when that thing is important for this person or this individual, and when that thing is not important for this person or individual, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah. One thing I would be curious about the conventional deadlift, I'm especially hesitating to use variations there, because I think the conventional on itself, it's pretty fatiguing. And if you introduce something like deficit deadlifts, or, I mean, I saw some funny variations I didn't see before, like floating deadlift, I think you called them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It looks like an RDL plus, let's say, like, or invisible block pull, or...
Yeah, so floating is... basically, it's just don't touch the ground. Just get as close to the ground as you can, right? Mm-hmm. But the position should be exactly the same as your normal deadlift, like in terms of the amount of knee break. I apply a lot of this. Basically, a lot of people, when they deadlift, they just kind of like flop down, and they don't build the musculature through the posterior chain, erectors, glutes, hamstrings included, you know, and floating is basically my answer to that without changing the positions greatly, right? So do stiff leggeds or RDLs separately. Floating is like, make it as similar to your actual deadlift as you can without touching the ground. So position is still a little bit more specific. But yeah, that's my answer to that.
I think Falk was using, we debated about eccentric deadlifts, and he said he's using just a soft touch when you lower the weight. And I think it's basically a similar concept, that you try to keep the tension and your positioning.
Yeah. The soft touch, I will say, I've done it in the past. The risk is a lot greater than the reward. So soft touch, if you touch unevenly, there's like, and if your load is heavy enough, which it should be because you need stimulus, right? You could, There's a risk of like messing up your back a little bit. I know it sounds fucking, you're going to mess up your back. but it's just an unnecessary risk in the soft touch if you like literally like just touch it unevenly, and then, you know. So that's why I don't do the soft touch. I would rather them just like stop this close to the ground, which you'll get like 99% of the stimulus anyway. So,
but yeah, that's an interesting topic. That was my original intent with the question. When you use variations on conventional deadlifts especially, are you worried about too much fatigue, or that you accumulate so much fatigue that you don't can do enough weight or volume? Or do you do something different to get the athletes to resist the amount of work you're doing? To make them more resilient, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So... philosophically, it depends, right? Like, so, it depends. It depends, right? So, if you're trying to coach someone that's a beginner transitioning to novice and intermediate, so on and so forth, you're probably trying to get more of a positive experience in training, so you can get the ball rolling, so to speak. when you're a high level athlete in your advanced, or you want to transition to advanced, there's a certain amount of work that has to be done to get to that level. You know, it's not the work potentially that you can recover from. Potentially, it's the work that you can't recover from. You're going to have to do a lot more than what you can recover from. Potentially, not always, but potentially. So I just prescribe the work that I think is necessary. And if you can't recover, and your goal is to be a high-level athlete, if you can't recover, then you look at externals and be like, sort it out, right? Like, if you're not, your nutrition's not on point and your sleeping's not on point and so on and so forth. Perhaps, like, Carlina's a little bit different because she has all of those on point except her work, right? Like, for a long time. Like, her work is a big part, obviously, right? If you're trying to be a high-level athlete, sometimes it's not about the work that you can recover from. It's the work that you have to do, right? And that's true in all sports, if that makes sense, right? In basketball, if you have to work on your three-point shooting, you're shooting 500 shots in the morning, 500 shots at night, right? Mm. Regardless if it affects your sleep or not. And then you got to figure shit out halfway along the way. You know what I mean? Like, powerlifters from training, because it's strength training and there's load behind it, we're trying to calculate, you know, oh, but this person can't recover from this, that, and the other thing. That's a good consideration to make if they're beginner or intermediate and they're just trying to enjoy the sport. That's not a good consideration to make if you're a high level athlete, if you're advanced. You know, you have to recover. Yeah. Sometimes you have to make that consideration because that person's just like, yeah, I want to be this, but also I want to work a corporate job so I could only train 3 times a week. That's fine, whatever, you know, then you have to make that consideration. So my point is, do you have an athlete or do you have a client? There's two different things. Client is, you know, trying to serve them, so on and so forth, make them stronger, whatever, blah, blah. Typical, you know, oh, coach, you know, this, that, and the other thing. Gonna make it be nice and all that kind of stuff. And athlete, you know, in powerlifting, it's both, but an athlete is different. Like, you got to understand who you have. An athlete will do what has to be done. An athlete will be told things that they might not want to hear and be okay with it. And they will be given work that they will struggle with to manipulate the rest of their lives to make work. But if you're an athlete and that's important to you, then, you know, that you'll find a way, basically. And that's what separates people, if that makes sense, in terms of performance. And if you treat a client like an athlete, they'll hate you for it. They'll say you're a shit coach because they ran me to the ground, because so on and so forth, you know, whatever, right? But if you have good marketing, those people won't go to you if you want to train athletes anyways, because you're very good at expressing, like, hey, I want athletes, you know, so to speak. So and I'm predicting the next question would be like, how do you know what that workload is, so to speak? How do you know that that's the amount of work that needs to be done? Right? Is that correct? I don't know.
How do you make this possible? I mean, how do you turn a client into an athlete then, basically? You also mentioned externals, but would you then make more sessions available and split the volume or intensity or do some other stuff like cardio to make them more resilient and give them more volume?
I don't try to turn clients into athletes. They tell me, or like either through conversation, they tell me as a part of their identity. You know, so like, am I more of an athlete than I am a client? Am I powerlifting for fun? Am I powerlifting because of strength training? Am I powerlifting to compete locally, nationally, so on and so forth? I don't make them athletes. Like from the beginning, Carlina came to me, just as an example, this is public. She came to me, she said she wanted to try powerlifting for a year. I don't know how long it took me. I think it took me, I want to say 2 weeks or 1 week, to say, hey, this isn't a thing for you to do to, you know, for that long. Like, this is your, you can be like, at the time I only said like the best in New Zealand. Right? Like, this is a thing that you could pursue in the future. It, I know it sounds Nostradamus, whatever, but I've said it to like 2-3 people. You know what I mean? Like, that's the one person or whatever that I've said that to. Otherwise, everyone else will tell me that want to be an athlete. Say, like, hey, I've seen myself as an athlete. I've been an athlete my whole life. This is just something that I'm going to do, transition from like that kind of athlete to this kind of athlete. And I'm willing to do the work. People say they're willing to do the work. Clients say they're willing to do the work because it's a cool thing to do. But the work sometimes isn't the amount of work or training volume that they prescribe. Sometimes the work is like, what are the shit that we have to do to recover from that? So something that Carlina is really, really, really good at that I could trust her is sleep, right? That's her performance enhancing quality. Like, she will sleep. She will get her sleep. So I know, like, and that is like terrible for a lot of people. Y'all, it's, what is it? 11:30 right now, you know, over there.
Yeah. So we are athletes. We are coaches.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I mean. Like, so I knew from the beginning, like, she's very rigid with her routine. She'll get her sleep. She'll get her recovery. She won't muck around and do random shit that would jeopardize her lifting. You know, I went on a fucking 3-hour trek. And then now my legs are cooked for my heavy squats. Like, I know that she won't do that stuff. She'll have her fun, like, post big meet and then be like, oh, hey, I need to clock out for like a month. I'm gonna exercise and mentally like unwind, you know? And then we literally like would barely talk to each other for like a month and she'll go do her thing. But once it's game time, like, I know that she'll dot the I's and cross the T's, especially more so now because she's kind of scaled back her work until World Games. And then after that, back to Carlina, full-time doctor and powerlifting as well. So yeah, if that makes sense at all, like, so I don't tell people, I don't try to turn clients into athletes. Like, they tell me that. And for the most part, most athletes will tell you, like, when a person walks through the door, it's like, oh, that person's an athlete. That person's not a client. Like, you can recognize it almost immediately. Like, they're a bit more serious than the next person, or maybe a lot more serious. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Yeah, absolutely. Because
I think you definitely struck a chord here and there with some with some occasions.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I wanted to get a little more insight on how Carlina is making this possible, because I have an athlete who also is looking to become a doctor and work as a medic. She is also a world-level athlete, placed 7th this year, 6th last year in the 63s. And I've found some parallels between Carlina and her, because somehow the people who want to be the best in the world, they are tuning the things as they need them to be to work out. So there are, yeah, her sleep also is the thing that's most reliable. Her food's on point. She gets in training and gets everything done. There's no hesitation. There's no debate on anything. We only discuss what needs to be better and what she can do to be better. And that's the mindset. Yeah, I think every coach is looking for. So, you know, the people you're working with, they are looking and working to get everything into place to make training and performance working. And that's where I absolutely support your point on day structure and training mindset. But moving on to a more, let's say, historical point, and go back a few months to Sheffield this year. There was like a tremendous performance by Carlina, placing 2nd, just behind Agata. And we've had preview episodes on the podcast here together with Pavel and his wife, Ula. Shout out to these two.
Yeah.
And I think we we've all had Carolina like in the top six, but no one really expected her to be this high in placings. So what did you think in advance to Sheffield this year? Was second place a realistic goal, or was it more of a surprise on that day?
I'll tell the story. So
please.
you mentioned, let's tell a story. So normally in Sheffield, for a lot of the new athletes and also a lot of the older athletes, they do this thing where they do a little bit of a walkthrough of the arena, and where you're going to go, where the warm-up area is and where the elevators are, so on and so forth. I was chatting shit with Powell, and I was just, and I hadn't listened to your podcast. I just did just now before they did this. And I didn't know what his opinions were. And I was just, oh, Powell, like, you know, what do you think? What do you think is going to win it? Powell's like, I don't want to misquote him. I was like, what, 108% maybe? And I was like, and who do you think's your next best contender? It's like, oh, Sunita, this percent, that percent. I told him, it's like, Sunita won't even get past us, buddy. And she didn't. And I listened to your podcast. She didn't get past us. And obviously it was just chopping shit, right? Like, you know, I'm just chatting shit with Powell. Obviously had to deal with him and that bloody Agatha for however many handful of years now, close to a handful of years now. But we're good, you know. But he thought obviously I was all full of shit. But basically the pull it back to actual comp, pull it forward to the actual comp, or even beforehand. Carlina and I walked in because we know we underperformed at Worlds. We know after Worlds we have a Nationals, but our Nationals is kind of like, hey, we'll relax a little bit. You know, you just did Worlds. So it's a long time between Worlds and Sheffield. And it's a long time to be forgotten with the recency bias kind of community that powerlifting is, right? It's fine. That we don't fault anyone for any of that. But if you actually break down the competition bit by bit by bit, I knew that podium was possible. We knew that podium was possible. And I thought second place was possible. We're not stupid. We've competed against Agatha. We knew that she'll be ahead by a lot. We're not going to be distracted by her. Just ignore her. She exists in a different plane for that competition. We're not gonna fuck with that, right? But with the rest of the competitors, I'm not sure if you guys seen my YouTube video of the breakdown. It's fine if you haven't. But the things that we were after is for us to overachieve, and then we'll probably have to rely on at least two of these three scenarios, right? The winner of the 63s underachieving, and Sunita doing what she did. Let's just put it that way. Evie potentially slipping up. The least likely to happen out of all of those would have been Evie. So I'm working probabilities here, right? Because Evie's been a high performer and consistent. So the least likely of those to happen is Evie. So now I'm relying on like the girls from the 63s and Sunita, right? Situation, being overconfident with her prep, people kind of building her up so she'd attempt something silly and then miss or whatever, which is kind of what happened. And then so on and so forth with the deadlift problems, because you're pushing your squat, your lever just won't as good, your deadlift lockout won't be as tidy. Exactly what happened at Sheffield is what I was counting on. And then with the 63s for the winner of that to underachieve because of some stupid bench technicality, which is what happened. Fortunately for us, three of those things happened instead of two. And then that opened up the door for Carlina to kind of walk through and then place on the podium and then second place as well. I was banking on at least two of those things to happen. And yeah, three things happen. Again, it's probability. The a lot of the podcasts afterwards said, oh, we're just running our own race and all that kind of bullshit. That's not what you do at high level. You don't run your own race. That's stupid. You have to play the game as it plays out. Like, you don't just, like, when you're playing soccer or football, you don't just dribble your own thing. You got to watch the whole thing, right? And you watch how people are playing the game. You watch their mental state. You watch their physical state. I saw Alba was... one of you guys, who was it that's like a big Alba believer that was on the pod?
He's not here.
He's not here. Yeah, he mentioned it. It's like, look, I'm not, I'm a fan of Alba, but on the day, she did look a little bit spooked and she's spoken about it post Sheffield podcast. Obviously corrected a lot of that this world's, right? On the day, she looked a little bit spooked. She's out over there. Leah wasn't posting anything, so she's probably off to the side. Megan Scanlon, by the second attempt bench, she was struggling, talking about hard bench. It's like, okay, well, the bench is hard. No help's going to come to you. You're out too, because they're not going to change the bench for you. And then Evie, you know, suddenly missing her second attempt was just like, wow, okay. That's it. Like, we're on the podium now. Like, so Carlina making her third bench. I knew we were on the podium by then. Commentators didn't. That's okay. They have their favorites. people didn't know because Sonita made her last deadlift and then it got overturned, but it wasn't announced. So then it was only announced that we came second once they were announcing the podium live. If that made sense at all. Like,
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So, because it wasn't overturned. But yeah, that's kind of how it all played out. I know it sounds silly, like hoping for people to miss and underachieve. But if you actually break down the probabilities of all of those things, like if you read the tea leaves, that you could kind of sense that there was a probability that those things would happen, like a pretty good probability those things would happen. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, but on top, it was her best performance up to there, wasn't it?
That was a given anyways, because our training our training was pretty good. Like leading into that, like we thought it would take more, like, to be honest. We thought that she would have to take the third squat and actually make that. After Worlds, we did a lot of rework in her programming and kind of like what was going on. And why the Worlds was underperformed. And training was just as good as it was or has ever been heading into Sheffield. It just so happens that on social media, it looks like it was like that for a lot of people as well. You know, like, everyone's training seemed good. It's just that, like, our training looked really good and it actually showed up on the platform. People's trainings looked really good. It just didn't, so.
I think this was a problem on Worlds, especially. I mean, Megan told her in her vlogs that it's the best training that she ever had. I mean, her gym numbers were very impressive. But yeah, I don't know if the flight and the whole time zone change.
I don't want to hear nothing about the flight and time zone change, bro. We fucking, y'all know how much we have to travel all the time. Like, bro, yeah, like our flights are like... crazy.
I mean, New Zealand is not the best position to travel in the world.
I've seen they are talking about putting Worlds next year or the year past that.
Yeah.
Maybe to New Zealand or Paris.
They'll go Paris. Come on, man. Everyone knows they'll go to Paris.
My fucking fingers crossed to put them putting it to Paris. But hey, mate, yeah, it would be comfortable for us. Because still, I think 1 to 2 hours, 2 hour plane ride, something like that. But you're obviously a man for the probabilities, and we want to stay in the historical fraction of the podcast and talk about this year's Worlds as well. Which have recently been in Germany. So, how did you see the situation with Krennen and Laura play out, because I didn't have them on my radar to this extent to make it that close to the end. How did you see the whole situation on that day, being so close and putting it all on the last pull? How was it for you and Kalina?
Do you want me to be nice or do you want me to be political?
Dude, okay. Put it out.
All right. Close. Let's define close. So she was out squatted, out benched, out deadlifted, out coached by a lot. Where's the close?
So who are you talking about?
Cranon.
Yeah. Okay. Because I've had yeah. Laura in the
yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
where is the close? You tell me.
Yeah. I mean, she had a serious attempt on her 262 and a half, something like that.
Yeah.
Quite didn't see it coming, but yeah, there was.
I mean, everyone heard it coming in the back room because bloody Flix was telling everyone, "We're just gonna go for it. We're just gonna go for it." It's just like, dude, just fucking shut up and just go for it, bro. Like, why do you have to broadcast it to everyone and wait for like a cameraman to hear you say it? Like, I'm sorry, is he big in Germany? I'll probably piss a lot of people off. But fuck it. I'm not hating on him.
Like in every country, I think, but
I'm not hating on this shit because yeah. Like if things would have played out another way, like he would open his mouth, right? So hey, let's open my mouth.
Yeah, please.
And kind of speak. Like, okay, so everyone talks about how close it was. And I understand more than anyone, I'm a sports marketing major, how important it is for the community to think that it was close, right? But again, there's three components, or if you include coaching or whatever, game day, out squatted, out benched, out deadlifted, out coached. Where is the close?
Yeah, making a good point there.
I mean, it's not like, oh, what could have happened? It's what actually happened.
I mean, I think that's what the point was. It wasn't the actual performance. It was like the numbers yeah. 4. I mean, on Sheffield, yeah. your performance was crazy. Everything else, everybody else was around 590. But yeah, definitely on the game day, you showed up with a lot of room.
I will. Let's break it down. Let's play devil's advocate. I really thought that on the day it would take 8 attempts, and we thought we would win on the second attempt deadlift. Okay. And on the day it took 8 attempts, that one attempt that's supposed to be the third deadlift was just the attempt that we missed in the squat, if that made sense at all. So it still did take 8 attempts. Yeah. Cause I didn't look past Cranon. Now I'm saying this, after the fact, right? Like we really, really didn't look past Cranon. Pete was talking to me a little bit. Oh, you know, Carlina should cruise through this. Pete Spence. Mm-hmm. SBD. I was like, no, Cranon's pretty good. Like, we know Cranon's pretty good. And Laura, if she makes her benches, she'll be right up there because her deadlifts are pretty good. And I know Cranon does this excruciatingly painful thing where she puts her top sets after like 3 minutes on her reels of like social media shit, right? Like influencer stuff. And then at the very end, you see her like for the last 3 seconds, you see her deadlift 250 at RPE 8.5. So when I'm doing my scouting, I'll be watching like Cranon's content and I have to watch like so much like of the influencer shit before I actually see the lifting.
Okay, man, I'm with you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So then I have to sit through it and I looked at her lifting and I'm just like, okay, she's good for 260, right? So when the day plays out, it's like, okay, squats plays out. Before that session, the 93 sessions were on. And then I saw on Flex's story, he was talking about how travel this, travel that, we need to get one at home for Keiko. So then in my head, I was like, oh, this travel thing's like kind of fucking with his head a little bit. Maybe he'll be conservative on Cranon squats because he's kind of getting spooked a little bit because of what happened to Keiko. Because he's gonna call her numbers, right?
Would you say that he went conservative on her squats, or
everyone knows that.
Yeah, okay.
Everyone sees that on the you know, how much more did she have left?
I can't tell. I didn't do the scouting for her.
She had like maybe 2.5, 5 more on the day, but you could tell that he was like it was playing in his head what happened to Keiko with the squats, right? Like so then I thought it's like there's a probability that he'll be conservative on squats. And then, lo and behold, he was. Now, for us, I thought in probability terms, like 225, if Carlina makes 225, it's still a high probability of winning, right? 230 plus, it's a guaranteed win, basically, apart from like being absolute shit on the other two lists, right? So that's why 225 was selected for the second, because 225 was always going to be like, if she makes that, it's a high probability. If she doesn't make that, it's going to be moderate to low probability of winning. So you take that on the second. Whether she makes it or not, that's on her. Like whether she makes depth or not, that's kind of on her. On the day, we were kind of lucky that we were on the second flight. So because we were on the second flight, I could see how it was refereed for the men. And then watching how the men were lifting and watching the standards that they were applying for the men, I'm just like, oh, okay. According to this standard, we're going to have to pull our numbers down a little bit. Like Carlina was good for 240, right? Like no one thinks that, but like I know that. But she was good for 240. We scored 225 because that's how the game was being called on the day. And we just barely got it in. You know what I mean? But that's what it is. It's just game of inches, right? Or whatever. But yeah, so by then, by squatting that, I was just like, I looked at the speed. This is the fastest she's squatted 225, like in forever. I'm just like, she's strong today. She'll pull 260 if she had to. But yeah, bench came through, you know, same thing, looking really strong. Bench VB. It's like, so physically, she's right there. She's ready. Like, I know people thought that it was close, but at the time, I was just like, oh, this is chill. Like, this is game over. Like, we're super duper strong. Like, we're not going to miss anything for the rest of the competition. Because technically officially she did, but technically she didn't. She stood up with all her lifts and all that kind of stuff. So no matter how slow it is, if you're playing at this level, you don't just fucking put what you think's on the board. You put what it takes to fucking win. and then on the time, how you would play the game, or how I played the game, is basically, if I remember correctly, Cranon was 7.5 kilos behind, but she had body weight. So what I would play, how I would play it is, I tried to change the opener. The American coaches, not Flix, change her, Cranon's opener. So Cranon would deadlift after Carlina so she could see the attempt. And then Joey Flix then threw a hissy fit out back saying like, hey, why'd you guys change your opener? I just want to like run my race and then pull for the win at the end. That's why at the first attempt, Cranon had the advantage to check the attempt selection. And then on the second attempt, it looked odd because she forfeited the advantage because we both attempted 245. Hmm. But Carlina had a higher lot number. So then now we get to see what she's going to put in for her last attempt deadlift. So they forfeited the advantage of seeing, right? Cranon moved hers way fast. We moved ours a little bit slower or a lot slower than Cranon's, right? Which suggests that she could have probably gone 247 and still had the advantage of looking, you know, what we're going to lift. Any case. So we're tied on deadlifts, but Carlina had the lead by 7.5 kilos. So we're still winning, right? And then in my head, I'm going to try to handcuff Cranon, or sorry, before handcuffing, I'm going to try to paint a golden bridge. So in negotiation, you try to paint a golden bridge. Like, look, you're 7.5 kilos behind with body weight advantage. I'm going to paint a golden bridge for you. I'm going to put 252.5. Okay. This is the number that you have to lift, Cranon. Okay. So this is the number that Cranon has to lift, right? So then that way she would take the lead. You still follow me, Fo? Yeah.
Yeah, I will. Mm-hmm. I will.
Yeah. So she would take the lead by going from 245 to 252.5. At the back, Flix, who's just looking for the camera, whatever the fuck he was doing, he was just saying, like, we're just going to go for it. We're just going to go for it. It's just like, bro, fucking play the game, dog. Like, come on, man. I'm trying to play chess and this dude, I don't know what the fuck he was doing. Whoa. like, anyways, he was
chess,
just...
Chess metaphors are very...
He just
love to be seen here with Maxi.
There you go. He just wanted to go for the win. It's like, look, like I see Flex as someone who is the master of simple. right? Like if you listen to his content,
that's a good
he is like, he always preaches the really, really basics and simple and all that kind of stuff. So at the time, I knew that he would try to go for the simplest answer. And the simplest answer is wait for us to pull, and then he pulls for the win, because that's the simplest answer. You just have to do math. You don't have to do shit, right? In my head, 252, and I'm just like waiting for this guy to like, dude, make a change, make a change. Come on, make a change. Not gonna make a change. Just talking about like, you know, he's gonna go for it. He's gonna go for it. It's like, fine, whatever. I'm gonna go 255. Now, from a game day standpoint, what that then forces Cranon to do is when we go 255, then our lot, because we have lot number advantage, she then has to attempt, if even if we miss, she has to attempt 257.5, right? Even if we miss, because she had the lower lot number, she can't go lower than us or our number.
Yeah.
Which is, even if we miss, which will be 5 kilos heavier than what she actually had to lift, which is 252. So the golden bridge was actually for her to take 252, right? Didn't want to take it. Fine, whatever. Last minute, 255. Now, whether we make or we miss, you're forced to take 257. In my opinion, she probably had 257 anyways. So Carlina had to make, right? Carlina makes. She, honestly, like, she probably had another 5 in there. I know people don't see it that way, but, you know, again, like, if you run max effort method, you'd see enough of Carlina's grinds for RPE 10. Which is also another advantage of max effort method, like a true RPE 10. It's like, you know, what the true RPE 10 is. So yeah, she probably had another 5, but we go 255, which would then make Cranon pull 262. Now, my research, again, like if you think back to our conversation, I thought Cranon was good for 260, which isn't a small number. It's fucking pretty good. So again, like, I'm not like trying to downplay her achievements. Like, I'm actually saying how fucking good she is, right? She's good for 260. So if I think she's good for 260, why the fuck would I make her pull 260? I gotta make her pull 262. So you don't make the person make, you make the person miss, right? So regardless of what I think Carlina is good for, or whatever anyone else think Carlina is good for, the right move was always 255, because it forces Cranon to hit 257, even if we miss, which is 5 kilos over than what she had to make. Or at best, if we make, it'll force Cranon to pull a number that she wasn't capable of. That's kind of how that deadlift battle played out. And again, I know I started the conversation about this battle quite arrogantly, but like, if you break it down, like, we never looked past her, but just after the fact, that's kind of like how it played out. On the side, Laura Motelin was kind of there, and I had to put her on park until after the bench, because the bench is when I get to see like, ah, shit, like, is she actually gonna be good for, you know, whatever. She had good bench day. So then she's like, okay, she's another one. I think she was behind by 10 kilos. She could have beaten Cranon. Cranon could have just as easily gone third place. But with regards to Laura, basically, I thought Laura would play the way that it's supposed to be played, which is what she did. Like, as soon as we went from 252 to 255, Laura's just like, ah, shit, I actually have to make this change, because she was 10 kilos behind and our second attempt was 245. So then she actually had to lift 255 because she was lower lot number. So then she made the change to 255. Her last deadlift was to pull for the lead. So she played the game, or the French team played the game and did what they were supposed to do. Laura just happened to miss her third attempt deadlift. That's all. But if she'd made it, she'd be in provisional first place. So that's how close Laura was. Yeah, if that makes sense at all.
Very emotional story. I mean, very emotional, the rivalry with Flex. It's
not rivalry with Flex, by the way. I'm just saying how it was. And
Like, yeah, it sounds a little bit like you have been downplayed, or that it was shown more close than it actually was in your view.
Yeah, look, like, again, I understand marketing. I understand, like, Cranon's presence and what she does for the community and the eyes that she brings. Look, I know how important it is for people to believe she was close. So fine, let her believe that she was close. Let them believe that it was close. It's okay. Like, let people believe that we weren't good for the podium on Sheffield. It's fine, you know?
I mean, you proved them wrong. I think that's the most important thing.
No, but, like, it's not that I'm trying to prove people wrong. It's just, like, it's okay. Like, what makes people feel, like, you know, alive inside, you know, with the closeness of the battle? It's okay. It's good for the sport, eventually. Like, net positive, right? Whatever. But you asked me if you wanted me to be nicer, to say whatever I fucking thought. That's how I thought.
No, it's all right. So what's up next for you and Carlina? You got the squat world record, and the deadlift is just, I think, 6 kilos away. So I think it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, so for Carlina, we've got World Games. So again, like, I know our performance at Worlds is below our performance at Sheffield. So it's probably a situation where we get overlooked a little bit, which is okay. Again, doesn't matter. But I'd really like to put forward a package, because this is like our last stretch. I'd really like to put forward a package that could out-total Agata physically. We're there. It didn't come to fruition at Worlds. World Games is judged differently. So there can be a situation if we do as well as I think we should do. That's also always a big if, right? Like, this whole podcast is about, like, people not doing as well as they think. But yeah, like, if we do as well as we think we could do, I think we could out-total Agata, but Agata will win because she is going to be of lower body weight, right? Because it's a GL points kind of situation. It's a little bit better for us. We still have to travel, like, 12 plus hours, but it's not as bad as Europe, where we're traveling, you know, 30 plus hours. So maybe that helps. But the main thing is for us is, like, yeah, just World Games, putting forward a good package, putting forward a package that's representative of the hard work that we're doing. Because that's what most people want to do, right? Like, heading into a competition, regardless of the, you know, what the outcome is it representative of what of the work that you did, right? If prep was bad, you know, you get a bad outcome. Most people are just kind of like, yeah, prep was pretty bad. You know, if prep was good, you get a shit outcome. It's like, oh man, that's not really representative of the work that I did and you know, the effort that I put in. So that's for us, for the rest of it is World Games. Is that. I also have another athlete, Joel Tassi, from New Zealand, who will be representing New Zealand at the super heavyweights as well. At World Games, she didn't go to Worlds this year just because we weren't selected for World Games until, like, later on, and it's just like a work leave kind of situation, and only had enough leaves for, like, one or the other, so we opted for the World Games instead of the World Champs. And then I also have Joy Namani, who obviously came third this year in the 57s, pulling for the win at the end there. Stood up a little bit too early on her deadlifts and kind of lost the win there to Sara Naldi. But we've got World Games too. So I'm going to be at 3 of the 4 weight classes at World Games. Yeah.
Not a bad statistic at all, I would say.
No, not. I'm just glad the girls, again, we could all be together and go compete together, because yeah, it's always fun. Like, you know, Joy's kind of on the other side of the world, but we end up seeing her quite frequently, especially with how frequent we go to Sheffield and Worlds and all that kind of stuff. And this time, World Games, so we get to see her again. So that's kind of cool. But yeah.
Can I ask how many athletes you have right now on your roster? I mean, you're saying you're running a gym on the side. Oh, man, not on the side.
Yeah, on the main now.
So I think it's part of everything.
I wouldn't be able to tell you off the top of my head. I just don't count, to be honest. I'd probably close to 40, if not a little bit more.
Okay.
My understanding is I charge a little bit less than a lot of the other international coaches, that especially from the States, especially the big name coaches or the coaches that are in more popular coaching circles. Right now, like I'm transitioning back into full-time work, or I am back in full-time work, not full-time coaching after 10 years. And I'm running a community gym that's like up to 1,000 members now, since I started with them.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, so the gym was like 780 when I started, I think, in May, and now we're at 1,060, should be by this morning. So growing pretty fast, a lot of movements and changes at the gym. It's also attached to like a big swimming pool, 7-lane, 25-meter swimming pool as well. So yeah, I'm having to run this gym. I got my team, I relocated them to the gym, and also like outfitting the gym so that the team is comfortable and they find it as like a new home, because we were based out of like a private weightlifting, powerlifting facility for so long. And as far as my online roster situation, look, like I know online coaching is the thing to do right now, and I'm probably going to shoot myself in the foot when it comes to the online community and like my potential for getting leads for this. But honestly, when I started the game, like, and I wanted to be a powerlifting coach, I didn't really envisage myself looking at a screen watching videos as my living. It evolved that way through the community, on the laptop, watching people lift. That's not how I wanted to coach, which is why Carlina is always very big when she's on podcasts about like the on-site work that I do, because I am significantly better on-site coach than I am online coach. And I'm not kind of afraid to say that. Publicly on an online international platform that then shoots me on the foot with potential leads, right? But yeah, like I just know now, having been in the game for so long and having tried the online thing, even while I was doing online all the time, I still kept my on-site coaching. I coached a lot of kids that come through my facility, through their schools for weightlifting, like really, really fostering, getting to know the individual, getting to know how they move, how they lift, how to build them from the ground up, where their weaknesses are. And again, going back to the very beginning part of our conversation, right, where the pieces of the kinetic chain, the hardware has to be improved and all that kind of stuff. So that's where I really, really lean on my kind of abilities as an on-site coach or an in-person coach. And yeah, so that's why I'm kind of transitioning back to more of that kind of work. But yeah, to answer your long-winded answer to your how many people in your roster, sorry. But yeah, that's kind of what I do.
But it's nice to hear. I think it's a big weakness of my coaching that I don't have this long experience with many, many athletes on site coaching who's starting with a lift. And I think that must be helping so much on how to explain the lift, on how to get the right cue for the right person if you have so many athletes every day in your gym.
But still, to add on to what you said, Dominic, is we happen to have our athletes pretty much around at least once a week for real life training sessions. And Maxi, same for you when you have the club training, and get closer to the people to improve their lifting. And what you just told us makes me hungry to get down to New Zealand and train at your gym one day. So maybe so let's see how the world situation will play out in 2 years. Maybe we will meet down in Auckland and maybe get a trip to your gym. But as of now, we want to thank everybody who joined in to listen to the podcast. Thank you, Dominic, for being on the show, for giving so much detailed insights, especially on the game day coaching stuff. That was really, really interesting, and I'm really hyped to rehear the episode when it's finished. So once again, thank you. thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, Maxi, for everything you do for the podcast, and see you and hear you in the next weeks. We're clocking out. Have a nice day to you, Dominic. Have a good night to you, Maxi, and to myself. And hopefully we can do that again.